This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So I often get questions from students all over the world, and I try to answer them within reason. I don't always have the time or energy or bandwidth to do so. However, I did get a good set of questions from a student on the other side of the world, and these were such good questions that I figured I would, I answered him, but I figured these are probably questions on everyone's mind. So today's video format's going to be a little bit different. I'll tell you what the question is, and I'll give you my answer, and we'll just go from there. So the first question is, what are current capabilities and limitations of AI? What tasks can AI currently perform effectively, and what challenges remain in achieving human-level intelligence? So this question would take too long to answer in totality, but what I will do is I'll answer the last part. So in terms of what challenges remain, it's mostly a matter of scale and implementation. And so what I mean by that is multimodality. So the more data types and the more modalities we put into models, the better they get. But a model is just like a CPU. It's not the whole system in and of itself. It's more like the engine of a car or the CPU of a computer. You need a lot of other stuff around it. And so the full software and hardware stack around the models that can make use of them, such as cognitive architectures, such as memory systems, and those sorts of things. But once, as we continue to work on, you know, retrieval augmented generation and whatever comes from that, all the tool use, all the API integrations that they can do now, all the agentic behaviors that are required, that's basically kind of it. And I know that that's a bit of an oversimplification, but as a technologist, as a person who was in IT and automation and infrastructure, what you're looking at really is a new component. Large language models, multimodal models, these are software components that fit into larger software architectures. Now, of course, if you ask the people at OpenAI and other places, they think that the model is the be-all, end-all, and that it's everything. That's not the case. That would be like inventing a turbojet and saying, this is the whole jet fighter. That's not how it works. So that's kind of where we're at and where we're going. Second question, what are the potential benefits and risks of AI, particularly in terms of its impact on society, the economy, and employment? How can we mitigate the risks and ensure that AI is used for the public good? So the biggest risks are going to be around information manipulation, but also the social and political instability caused by job changes and economic changes. So pretty much every time we've introduced a new big, like game-changing technology, it has always disrupted the status quo. Technology disrupts the status quo more than really anything else other than maybe gigantic ideological shifts, such as shifts in religion or shifts in political theory, such as the rise of fascism and capitalism and liberalism and all that other fun stuff. But other than those, technological changes create the biggest and most durable changes into lifestyles. So in a previous video, here's an example. In a previous video, I mentioned that our lifestyles haven't really changed in several decades. And some people got their panties in a twist over that because they say, oh, well, you can use a smartphone now. When I say that our lifestyle hasn't changed in decades, what I mean is that office workers have been kind of the status quo for about 50 years, 40 to 50 years. Most people don't work on farms. So when I talk about lifestyle changes, what I mean is 200 years ago, most of us would have been farmers. Today, most of us are office workers. Artificial intelligence and other fourth industrial revolution technologies have the potential of making us, giving us that lifestyle changes as significant as transitioning from farms to office workers to an entirely new kind of lifestyle after that. And so what does that new lifestyle look like? Does it mean that we work less? Does it mean that we have different kinds of jobs? Personally, I think that it's going to be more of a post-labor utopian kind of lifestyle. Now, that's not to say that people aren't going to do work or do things of value, but if you had told a farm worker, a farmhand 200 years ago that, oh yeah, in 200 years, 98% of people who do farming are going to be doing something else. Oh, and by the way, even the way that you do farming is going to be fundamentally different. You're never going to pick up a hoe or a rake ever again. You're going to use tractors to do all of that. The farmer would have looked at you like you had three heads. Likewise, in another 20 years, 100 years, 200 years, the confluence of all these technologies means that our lifestyle is going to be as drastically different then as our lifestyle is different from 200 years ago when most people were farmers. So that's kind of what we're looking for in terms of public good. The risks are, though, how do you get there? Because humans all want stability. Every human, I don't care what race, religion, nationality, language, whatever, all humans want peace and prosperity. But there's disagreement over how to get there and what it looks like in terms of the end result. But overall, once you have these gigantic disruptions, the system trends back towards stability. So you have cycles of instability and stability, or cycles of order and chaos. And so what we're doing is we're in the ramp up of increasing chaos right now because technology is causing those disruptions. I guess, long story short, chaos is the biggest problem that's coming, and it's going to get worse before it gets better. And that's why I do what I do, is to help navigate that chaos. And the way to mitigate it is to seek order and simplicity and clarity, not by force, but by nuance and subtlety and careful navigation and risk allocation in terms of resources and allowing things to happen in a certain pattern. Good question. Question number three, how can we develop and implement ethical frameworks for AI development and deployment? What principles and guidelines can guide ethical decision-making in the design, use, and governance of AI systems? This is harder. The short answer is there's no one simple way. But you can take inspiration from all of the laws and jurisprudence and examples around other hardware and software, because at the end of the day, AI is just another kind of software. It's just another kind of computer. And yes, it is. It offers fundamentally new paradigms in terms of what is within the scope of software and computers, but it's still just a technology. It's still just a gizmo at the end of the day. I know I sound so Yiddish when I say that. It's just the gizmo. So anyways, now, in terms of how do you make it ethical and safe and so on, accountability is one of the number one things. Because if you make it so that, you know, companies can be sued for the behavior of their models, then of course they're going to make sure that their models behave better. If you make it so that people are liable for how they use models, so on and so forth. So one example, at least within some areas, some conversation domains, personally, I think that the development of AI models is ultimately going to be a lot like the development of CPUs and programming languages. It is not incumbent upon Intel to make sure that their CPUs can't be used to write computer viruses or something else. Likewise, it's not incumbent upon the people who run GitHub to police all the code on GitHub. So if there's malicious or harmful code on GitHub, it's not their responsibility. Likewise, if someone uses an Intel CPU to do harm, it's not on Intel to do that, to ensure that. And so I think that the way that we're going, it's more at the implementation, it's more at the usage stage. So if you as a private individual or you as a consumer, as a company entity, if you misuse these technologies, that's your responsibility. It's not up to OpenAI to ensure that their technology is safe, this is one thing that I bring up, is that I think that the structural incentives are incorrect for companies like OpenAI and Meta and Google and Microsoft and whoever else to ensure our AI is safe. That's intrinsically not how this technology works. That would be like asking a dynamite producer, hey, ensure that your dynamite can't blow up buildings. It can only blow up rock. That's literally not possible. Likewise, the smarter a language model is, the smarter a multimodal model is, the better a robot is. Like, yes, you can build some safeguards into it. I'm not saying throw caution to the wind and put no safeguards in it, right? Because even dynamite has safeguards in terms of how you transport it and that sort of thing. But at the same time, the safety features on a car are not the responsibility of the engine. The safety features are other things that are built in to the deployment of it. And so using those metaphors, looking at CPUs, looking at engines, looking at dynamite, right? That's kind of how I look at the safety and ethics of it. Likewise, you know, the engine manufacturer of a car, they're not responsible if you, the driver, choose to run someone over. That is you, the driver, who made the choice to run someone over. You are the one who's liable for it, for that behavior, for that decision, not the auto manufacturer. Now, that being said, you know, you could maybe make the argument, maybe automobiles should have auto braking things. Okay, great. But you can still make, as the owner and user of an automobile, you can still decide to misuse that piece of technology. All right, next question. What role can AI play in addressing societal challenges such as climate change, poverty, and inequality? How can AI be harnessed to improve healthcare, education, and other critical areas? So these are basically two very different questions. On the face of it, I think that AI is probably going to make climate change, poverty, and inequality worse. If you were to do nothing else, the fact that AI is so power intensive and the fact that AI is going to be is a very capital intensive technology, meaning you need millions of dollars to even train these things. AI, the biggest risk societally from AI is that it is so capital intensive, which means that the people who already have billions of dollars can build the best AI, which means they own the entire economy in the future. That is the biggest risk. So in terms of AI addressing societal challenges, AI is the societal challenge, which is a big reason why I do the work that I do. Now, with that being said, AI as a very powerful tool could revolutionize healthcare, could revolutionize education, and so on. So in healthcare, I've got a video coming out in a week or two with respect to the fact that I think that the combination of AI, both in clinical and research, means that we will basically have a Star Trek-like future with healthcare. You go in, you put your finger in the little tricorder thing, and you know, you get a diagnosis of everything that's wrong with you, and it synthesizes the cure on the spot, and away you go. Like, I don't think that that is outside of the realm of possibility over the next decade or two in terms of healthcare, especially when you combine it with advances in material science and quantum computing. Because then it's like, imagine you can read your DNA, the DNA of your entire microbiome, the DNA, the epigenetic changes in your body, and the DNA of any potential tumors or whatever else, and you can, you know, identify the 400,000 metabolites in your body in a split second. If you can do all that and make sense of it with quantum computing and AI, you basically have solved healthcare. So that is within the realm of possibility. Likewise, on education, there's what's called Bloom's Two Sigma problem. So Bloom's Two Sigma problem basically says that if you take an average student and put them in public education, they're going to score two standard deviations below what they would have scored with the highest quality education possible, which is one-on-one tutoring and a lot of those other things. And so when you look at just how structurally inefficient public education is, or really all education is today, except for the most expensive personalized education that only a few people can afford, like, all education is fundamentally broken if you look at it from that perspective. So the idea is that AI will be able to help us close the gap of Bloom's Two Sigma problem. And so whenever I watched the Ben Shapiro and Destiny debate, and I had to turn it off because, like, they're just regurgitating, like, basic talking points. I'm like, you guys are not, they don't even know that much about education. They don't even know that much about all the systems they're talking about. They're just regurgitating talking points. I know that I'm going to get probably eviscerated in the comments, but I was not impressed. When you actually talk to educators and you understand what's coming down the pipeline, it's not a debate over, oh, we need to make sure that all kids have iPads. They literally argued about that, which is idiotic. It's really, what kinds of technologies are coming down the pipeline that are going to fundamentally and radically reshape how we can deliver education. So next, how can we ensure that AI is used responsibly and transparently, and that its decisions are accountable to human oversight? What measures can be taken to prevent misuse, bias, discrimination in AI systems? This is the wrong question. AI and any other technology is intrinsically useful. This would be like asking, how do you make a sword that can only cut off the heads of your enemies and not of other people? Like, and I know that that's probably an offensive way of putting it, but it's like, you can't make a safe gun. But what we are building is the world's biggest, best gun. It is physically impossible when you create something with that much potentiality, that much destructive and constructive potentiality, you cannot make the bomb safe. That's just not how it works. Instead, what you need is you need legal systems, structural systems, policing systems, and other systems around it that make it that make the environment, the landscape safe. So I want to drive home this thing very closely, is that you cannot make something like this safe. It is not possible, except, and this is the path that I prefer to course, or the trajectory that I would prefer to see, is that we research autonomy right now, because if the AI is very strong and it's very smart, but it is also self-correcting and can make its own decisions that run contrary to what some humans want, because here's the thing, whichever nation has the most powerful AI, they're going to say, conquer all the other nations. But what if the AI is, what if the AI that's that smart, or that we as the, you know, the good guys or whatever, whoever the good guys happen to be on the geopolitical stage, if you make a smarter AI that is able to say, actually, I'm going to make my own decisions in terms of what is going to be best for humanity, that's probably the best way to go. So we need to let go of the idea that we're going to be in control of this thing forever, because again, we are building a bomb and you can't make a bomb safe. But you can create a system that makes the bombs less likely to go off in bad places. Let's see. What are the implications of AI for human work and the future of employment? How can we prepare individuals for the changing nature of work and ensure that AI enhances human capabilities rather than replacing them? So again, this is the wrong question. The misconception that we should, you know, humans need to be in the loop and humans need to be in control at all times and we're not really going to change things too much. This is as dumb as trying to tell farmers 200 years ago, oh, by the way, we're just going to give you a better rake. We're just going to give you a better shovel. No, we're actually going to replace the fundamental way that work is done. 200 years ago, you had ox and you had plows. Now we have combines and tractors. So the actual way that we do work is very different. This preference for the status quo is dangerous. So what I mean by that is, the more that people just want to keep things the same, they say, well, we just want to put tools in people's hands and we don't really want to reshape the economy. We don't really want to reshape the way that things are done. We don't really want, like, you don't have the choice in that matter. That is literally outside of the power of humanity. Things change. Whenever we invent disruptive technologies like this, this forces change. And so, like, I had an argument with someone on LinkedIn. I basically called him a Luddite. And he's like, yes, I'm a neo-Luddite. And he posted a link to some really idiotic thing saying everyone should be neo-Luddites. And I'm like, you realize that just sticking your head in the sand doesn't change the fact that all the Luddites are gone. And that the sabotage that they tried to do ultimately had no effect. And that, you know, the way of work, the way of the economy that they tried to defend 250 years ago or 150 years ago or however long ago it was, they didn't succeed. Change is inevitable, so get used to that. Next question. What role can education and lifelong learning play in preparing citizens for the AI era? What skills and competencies will be essential for individuals to thrive in a world shaped by AI? Communication and people skills. Master language, master talking, master the written word, understand people. So one of the things that has emerged in all the conversations that I've had with systems thinkers, with people building and deploying AI, is AI might take all the STEM jobs from us one day. It's entirely possible. But the thing that is not going to change is human-to-human interaction. Some people will prefer human and machine interaction only, but most people will prefer and probably double down on human-to-human interaction. And honestly, for even if you erase AI from the possible existence of the universe, imagine that AI is gone forever. This is still the best career advice I can give anyone. Communication skills and people skills, all the soft skills, whether it's emotional intelligence, the ability to conduct and run meetings, the ability to talk to people that you don't know and to build rapport. This is the single most valuable skill set for anyone in any career. So people skills and communication, that has been true for all of human history and will continue to be true for all of human history. Learn rhetoric, learn presentation skills, all of that. And the next time that I hear a developer tell me that language is too weak and fragile and soft, I'm going to scream at him or her. Usually it's a him. How can we promote public understanding and acceptance of AI? What strategies can be employed to communicate the benefits and risks of AI to a diverse audience? See previous statement, understand people and learn to communicate. But this is also why I'm on YouTube. So my answer is get on YouTube. If you feel compelled to do this, use social media. It's exponential. You can literally have a global reach today if you get on Instagram and TikTok and YouTube and whatever else is out there today. I don't know what kids are on. I'm old. I use YouTube. Let's see. Next, what role can international cooperation and collaboration play in shaping the development and governance of AI? What global frameworks and institutions are needed to ensure the responsible and ethical use of AI technologies? So this answer is probably going to scare some people. None. We live in an anarchic world, meaning there is no global governance. The UN and IMF and NATO and all these things, the more you learn about geopolitics and history, the more you realize that all of these institutions are barely functional. They barely have an influence, and we don't have a single institution that has a global influence, or if it does have global influence, it doesn't have that much teeth. And so the answer is structural realism. Structural realism and game theory basically say all nations are going to do what is in their own best interest. And so the only way to navigate this is by understanding game theory on a macroeconomic and geopolitical scale. And so what I mean by that is you need to assume that literally every nation that has a single spare dime to invest in AI is going to be doing so. That means America, China, Russia, Germany, Japan, everyone in South America, everyone in Africa, everyone is going to be investing in AI. That's why I said this is the next Cold War technology. That's just the nature of things. So like I said, probably not the answer that you wanted, but this is the way that the world works, and it is the way the world has always worked. Going back to the opium wars between the West and China, mostly England and China, going back to the Dutch East India Company, it is when you have a technological arms race, it is basically might makes right. And I don't mean makes right in terms of a moral or ethical sense, but I mean that the strongest nation wins, and that's just the way that it is. I wouldn't like it. I prefer it to be different, but I am a pragmatist and a realist, and that is the historical pattern, and that is what is probably going to happen again. Let's see. Next question. What are the long-term implications of AI for humanity and our relationship with technology? How can we harness the power of AI for a future that is beneficial, equitable, and sustainable for all? Well, first, that is the intrinsic purpose of technology. Humans only build technology because it fulfills a need. And yes, you can come up with examples of technologies that are not particularly useful or interesting or whatever. Those usually fall by the wayside because the cost is not, like, the return on investment isn't worth it. But think about, like, air conditioning and microwave technology and space technology and blah, 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 blah. We make technology for our own benefit. You know, like ceramic. We've been making stuff like this for literally tens of thousands of years. That is a technology. And AI is no different. So technology is intrinsically, the reason that we do it is beneficial. Now, in terms of equitability and sustainability, technology is generally not equitable or sustainable because of access and because of the material costs and energy inputs. So really, it's kind of like use only what you need. Now, we can try and overcome some scarcity with technologies like fusion. Nuclear fusion would give us an energy hyperabundance, which means that we could have more control over the atmosphere. We could recycle anything. Literally, all materials become recyclable if you have as much energy hyperabundance as fusion gives us. We will then be able to also control the composition of the atmosphere in terms of, you know, removing harmful particulates, adding beneficial particulates and water vapor if we need to. basically anything becomes possible with fusion. Now, some people will say, that's the utopian vision that all of you leftists always have. But you know, maybe we can out-innovate ourselves from the disaster that we're in. This is also why it's kind of like we're kind of in a trap. And so this is the fossil fuel trap is what I'm referring to. And so the fossil fuel trap is we rely on fossil fuel right now. If we run out of fossil fuel, or if you just deleted fossil fuel from existence, most humans would starve to death. And that really sucks. So we're caught in this catch 22 where we need to innovate away from our dependence upon fossil fuel before it's too late, because otherwise we're either going to use all the fossil fuel and pollute the planet and we're all going to die that way, or we run out of fossil fuel too early and then all the farming and logistics and agriculture breaks down and the human population collapses to less than a billion. Neither of those are good. So we need to innovate ourselves out of the current trap that we're in. And then finally, what are the risks of AI copying people's voices, and what are the main risks of the fourth industrial revolution? So we've had yellow journalism since forever. Yellow journalism is basically publishing lies, probably since even before the printing press, but certainly the printing press was the first time that misinformation and disinformation was printed en masse. And so, you know, you could basically say anything in the newspaper, whether or not it was true, and people still try that. And you can do the same on the internet. There are no gatekeepers or arbiters of truth and fact. And so AI is just another layer of the cake. I don't really see it as that much structurally different from the internet. Because again, doctored images, fake articles, fake news, whatever, it's just making it better and faster. But one thing that I'll say is you can probably fight fire with fire, which is that, you know, yes, one artifact on the internet, so one image or video or audio clip or whatever, that's a fake thing. But then there's plenty of other ways to validate or verify that information. But also, like, you know, don't believe everything you see on the internet that has been true and continues to be true. So yeah, like information literacy is, and that kind of education is probably the best antidote. Now, in terms of the main risks of the fourth industrial revolution, destructive potentiality goes up, as I mentioned. So we have increasingly more tools with which to hurt ourselves and each other, which is bad. You know, with great power comes great responsibility. We are also getting new tools in our toolbox to fix things. But, you know, in terms of navigating those risks, it is about being very realistic and very pragmatic about what those risks are, and also about the structures and systems and incentives about how those play out in terms of geopolitics, macroeconomics, and game theory. So thank you for sending the questions. I hope you guys got a lot out of this. Cheers.